Number 1636 through 1832, the seventh talk in a series on the narrative portions of Numbers, was presented by David Crabtree on December 5, 2004, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at Numbers, the end of chapter 16 is where we'll start. Last week we looked at Korah's rebellion, in which there were three Israelites who instigated a rebellion against the leadership of Moses and Aaron. Those were Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. But they were supported by 250 other Israelite leaders. And apparently the challenge was primarily to Aaron's monopoly on the priesthood. That the argument was, we are all holy. And apparently the conclusion that could be drawn from that is that we should all be equally capable of approaching God with our concerns. And so Moses had all of these leaders appear before in the presence of God with censers burning incense, a prerogative that was only for the priests. And when that happened, God responded first by opening up the earth and swallowing up the three instigators, and then the earth closed in on them. And then fire consumed the 250 other leaders who were burning incense in God's presence. So God acted in judgment against all of those people who had risen up in rebellion against Moses and Aaron. So now we'll look at the ensuing events that followed after that judgment. Starting with verse 36 of Numbers 16, going through 40. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Say to Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, that he shall take up the censers out of the midst of the blaze, for they are holy. And you scatter the burning coals abroad. As for the censers of these men who have sinned at the cost of their lives, let them be made into hammered sheets for a plating of the altar, since they did present them before the Lord, and they are holy. And they shall be for a sign to the sons of Israel." So Eleazar the priest took the bronze censers which the men who were burned had offered, and they hammered them out as a plating for the altar, as a reminder to the sons of Israel that no layman who is not of the descendants of Aaron should come near to burn incense before the Lord, that he might not become like Korah and his company, just as the Lord had spoken to him through Moses. So God speaks to Moses and says that Eleazar, who is the son of Aaron, so he would be of the priestly line, that he needs to go out and pick up all the censers and scatter the coals. Now, why Eleazar? It's not clear. The rabbis say that it's because Aaron, the high priest, is prohibited from coming into contact with a corpse, with a dead body. So that's why he would be prohibited, otherwise he would become unclean. That may be part of it. But it seems to me that what we see in Numbers is a shift of responsibilities from the older generation to the newer generation. We see that slowly taking place. And I think here we see Aaron's son stepping in and beginning to fulfill some of the responsibilities of Aaron, because Aaron is going to die soon. And we see that in the text. So I suspect that's why Eleazar is asked to do this. What he's supposed to do is pick up, and this is the language, if you take it at face value, indicates that it's still burning. So he's supposed to go in while it's still burning, and he's supposed to pick up the censers and the burning coals. He's supposed to gather all of those. And he says that God says the censers need to be picked up because they're holy. And why are they holy? Because they have been offered unto God. And then there's something special that needs to be done with those censers. I don't know what this means. This is rather curious. He doesn't have him return the coals. He doesn't have him gather up the coals. He doesn't say that the coals are holy. Now, the coals for burning incense, according to the law in Exodus and Leviticus, there is always supposed to be a fire going at the altar. And to burn incense, the priest is supposed to take coals from the altar, put it in the censer, and then add the incense and burn it from those coals. Presumably, these 250 pretenders to being priests did not get coals from the altar. Presumably, they just used whatever coals to burn their incense. But it's interesting that God doesn't ask them to gather up the coals and put those on the altar, because there's a sense in which, it seems to me, those two were presented to God. So I'm not sure what's going on here. This is one of those places where, in my thinking, I'm just going to have to file it away as one of those details to keep in mind. What does it mean when it says that it is holy because it was presented to the Lord? I suspect it's significant, but I don't really know the significance of that yet. They were supposed to take then the coals and scatter them abroad. They were supposed to be scattered out widely, but the censers are to be pounded out into thin metal, and that is to be placed on the altar as a covering on the altar. There are two pieces of furniture that are referred to as the altar in the tabernacle. One is the altar on which the sacrifices are made, and that one, as instructed in Exodus, was to be covered with bronze. The other one is the incense altar. That, as instructed in Exodus, is to be covered with gold plating. Well, these censers, which are made out of bronze, are to be pounded out and put over the altar. It's not clear which altar, but it seems to me it makes the most sense that these would go over the altar that is for burning incense. Incense has been the heart of this whole incident. The burning of incense has played a key role. It seems to me it makes most sense to go on that particular altar. If that's the case, then what God is telling them to do is take a bronze covering and put it over a gold covering. And I think what that's designed to do is raise the question, why is a gold covering being covered up with a bronze covering? And the answer to that is because of this incident. It's a reminder that there was this incident in which those who were not priests pretended to be priests. They wanted to be priests, and God judged them for that. Okay, then Eleazar does as he was instructed to do. The next section, 41 through the end of the chapter. But on the next day, all the congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, saying, "You are the ones who have caused the death of the Lord's people." It came about, however, when the congregation had assembled against Moses and Aaron, that they turned toward the tent of meeting, and behold, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord appeared. Then Moses and Aaron came to the front of the tent of meeting. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Get away from among this congregation, that I may consume them instantly." Then they fell on their faces. And Moses said to Aaron, "Take your censer, and put in it fire from the altar, and lay incense on it. Then bring it quickly to the congregation, and make atonement for them, for wrath has gone forth from the Lord. the plague has begun. Then Aaron took it as Moses had spoken and ran into the midst of the assembly, for behold, the plague had begun among the people. So he put on the incense and made atonement for the people. And he took his stand between the dead and the living, so that the plague was checked. But those who died by the plague were 14,700, besides those who died on account of Korah. Then Aaron returned to Moses at the doorway of the tent of meeting, for the plague had been checked. This is the next day. It's the next day, and the people come complaining, and they hold Aaron and Moses responsible for the fact that the 250 as well as the families of the three have been killed in God's judgment. That is truly amazing. This is a hard-hearted people. They're very resistant to understanding what God is doing and what God is trying to communicate to them. And I'm going to talk about this more after I finish this chapter. We'll come back to that. So the people have gathered around Moses and Aaron. They hold Moses and Aaron responsible for what had happened in the deaths of those people. And they are complaining about that. At that time, then, God appears at the tent of meeting. The glory shines. So God makes his presence known. Aaron and Moses fall on their faces again. We've seen this time after time. And once again, they ask God to be merciful, or presumably merciful towards the congregation, because the congregation, God wants to, he asks Moses and Aaron to step back. He's going to wipe them all out. And once again, Moses and Aaron apparently lobby for their countrymen. It is amazing how many times Moses and Aaron ask for mercy for their countrymen, despite the countrymen's animosity towards them personally. That's truly remarkable. Then Moses says to Aaron, and apparently this is at God's direction, take the censer, take coals from the altar, and burn incense, and then go out in the midst of the people. And that incense will be as an atonement to God. And apparently in the ancient Near East, burning incense was always a way of asking for God's mercy. That was universally what burning incense seems to have meant. And that seems to be appropriate here as well. Aaron is supposed to go out and stand in the midst of the congregation burning incense. He does so. The plague, as God has already said, has already begun, and it's sweeping through the camp. Now, it's not clear what kind of plague this is. It is apparently fast-acting, and it seems to be moving through geographically. That is, it doesn't hit people at random. It seems to be moving through spatially. And one could only guess that it starts from the area where the south of the temple, where both Korah and the Reubenites camped. But that's speculation on my part. It's sweeping through. Aaron stands out in the midst of the congregation with the censer, and the plague stops. So Aaron is standing then between the living and the dead, and they are separated by the burning incense. The appeal for God's mercy. Nevertheless, 14,700 people die as a result of this plague. Then Aaron returns to Moses at the doorway of the tent of meeting, for the plague had been checked. Okay. What is going on here? How can it be that people who have just seen a dramatic instance of God's judgment would nevertheless be rebellious against God once again? I have thought about this, and I'm trying to put myself in their shoes as much as I possibly can. And how could they be looking at this? And this is my best guess. Because before I go into this, you would think that just having seen the earth open up and swallow the three ringleaders' families, that even if they didn't like Moses or Aaron or God, that at least they would be quiet. They wouldn't come complaining to Moses and Aaron. You would think that they would be stilled from that, but that does not seem to be the case. And when they come, they accuse Moses and Aaron of causing the death of Yahweh's people. So there's a sense in which they don't seem to make the connection that what they're doing is rebellious towards God himself. They seem to think that their rebellion is against Moses and Aaron, quite apart from God. That they are nevertheless being loyal to God. So this is a stubbornly rebellious group. They are refusing to see what God has done as, in fact, the act of God and an act of judgment. This last week, I heard a very interesting interview with a modern Israeli novelist. He wrote a novel called A Tale of Love and Darkness, which is apparently the highest best-selling novel in Israel right now, and apparently is selling well outside of Israel also. It was by Amos Oz. He's a novelist who was born to Jewish parents who left Central Europe in the 1930s because of anti-Semitism that they were experiencing. They tried to go wherever they could. They tried to go to America, to France. They even tried to go to Germany. But the only place where they could go was to Israel, so they emigrated to Israel. And this novel is apparently autobiographical, talking about life in Jerusalem in the 1930s and then on through to the present. It sounds like an interesting novel, but I won't go into more detail on that. But in part of this interview, the interviewer asked him if he is Jewish religiously. And his response was, no, I am just a cultural Jew. That is, I identify with Jewish culture. And then he went on to list what he considers to be the distinctives of Jewish culture. And it's things like a natural cynicism, humor in the face of evil. And he listed about a dozen things. But there was one that jumped out at me. He said, Jews are rebellious towards authority and given to a certain degree of anarchy. And I thought, that's the same people that I've been reading about in Numbers. I mean, there is a rebellious people. I mean, maybe it is true that one of the features of that culture that develops out of this people that God chose is a rebelliousness against authority, a kind of, they are a stiff-necked people, as the Old Testament refers to them. And if that's true, then it started way back at the time of Moses. Now, what are they thinking? What could possibly justify their actions? My best guess is that they are seeing Moses and Aaron as either people to whom God has given a certain amount of power for them to use as they see fit. And that what happened with the earth opening and closing on the ringleaders of the rebellion, that was Moses' action using power given to him by God. So like a magician or something like that. Seems to me that that's possible. The other possibility is that they see Moses and Aaron as being able to communicate directly with God, which which Moses does, and that they serve as advisors for God, and that they are directing God in certain ways, and that they are the ones who put God up to doing what he did. But if God knew the full picture, he wouldn't have done that. Now, my model in thinking that that might be the case is that's a common phenomenon in Europe in the 16 and 1700s, when you have monarchies in Europe, and the people are inclined to think very well of their king. And if they see things go, policies being enacted that the people don't like, that are very aggravating, the people don't tend to blame it on the king. They tend to blame it on the king's advisors. And that's a phenomenon that the kings of Europe took advantage of, because it was a way of deflecting blame from themselves, and they would encourage people to deflect the blame onto their advisors. Then you could just fire an advisor, get another advisor, and the king stays blame-free. So my suspicion is there might be something happening along those lines. In any case, they seem to think that they are still being loyal to Yahweh, despite all that's happened, that they are still being loyal to Yahweh. Which leads me to believe that they are devoted to something other than the real Yahweh. And that's a phenomenon that we see elsewhere in the Old Testament, and I think we also see in the New Testament, and it's a phenomenon that we all need to be cautious of. And that is to worship a God that is not the real God, but a God of our making. God as we would like him to be, God rather than God as he truly is. Come to know God is indeed a gift from God. It's an act of mercy that he reveals himself to us as he is. That's true on the one hand. But on the other hand, it also has a moral dimension to it. That as rebels against God, we are resistant to seeing God as he truly is. And we substitute for the God who really is a God that's more to our liking. And to face into him as he really is an act of God on the one hand, that's true, but on the other hand, it is a moral act. It is a moral act in that we are saying, I want to believe that which is truly true, whatever that may be. And that takes an integrity that can only come from God's mercy. Okay, the next section then, one more sign having to do with Aaron's legitimacy as priest. Verses 1 through 11 of 17. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, and get from them a rod for each father's household, 12 rods from all their leaders according to their father's households. You shall write each name on his rod, and write Aaron's name on the rod of Levi. For there is one rod for the head of each of their father's households. You shall then deposit them in the tent of meeting in front of the testimony, where I meet with you. And it will come about that the rod of the man whom I choose will sprout. Thus I shall lessen from upon myself the grumblings of the sons of Israel, who are grumbling against you. Moses therefore spoke to the sons of Israel, and all their leaders gave him a rod apiece, for each leader, according to their father's households, 12 rods, with the rod of Aaron among their rods. So Moses deposited the rods before the Lord in the tent of the testimony. Now it came about on the next day that Moses went into the tent of the testimony, and behold, the rod of Aaron for the house of Levi had sprouted and put forth buds and produced blossoms, and it bore ripe almonds. Moses then brought out all the rods from the presence of the Lord to all the sons of Israel, and they looked, and each man took his rod. But the Lord said to Moses, put back the rod of Aaron before the testimony to be kept as a sign against the rebels, that you may put an end to their grumblings against me, so that they should not die. Thus Moses did, just as the Lord had commanded him, so he did. So once more, God is acting in a way to establish Aaron's right to be the priest, to have a monarchy, a monopoly on the priestly activities. And this time what he asks, there's no provoking incident that brings this about. This is at God's initiative. And what God asks is that Moses take the staff from the leader of each tribe. And the staff typically is is distinctive. Each person has their own distinct staff and should be able to recognize it among all others. At least that's the custom in the ancient Near East. So he takes the staff from the leader of each tribe, and just to make sure that everyone knows, he has them engrave their name in that staff. And then those staffs, and this is all according to God's directions, those staffs are placed before the testimony, it says. Now the testimony refers to the tablets that God wrote and gave to Moses at Sinai. And those tablets were placed in the Ark of the Covenant. So these rods then are being placed right in front of the Ark of the Covenant in the tabernacle. 12 of them, or is it 12 or 13? It could be either. Generally speaking, in Numbers, when it refers to the tribes of Israel, it's referring to the secular tribes. That is, it doesn't count the tribe of Levi. However, Joseph had two sons, and those become half tribes. So when it says 12 tribes in Numbers, generally speaking, it's the 12 secular tribes, including the two half-tribes. So although the language is not clear, apparently there are 13 rods that are placed in front of the Ark of the Covenant. The 12 secular tribes, and then Aaron's staff. By the way, the word for tribe and the word for staff here, it's the same word in Hebrew. So there's a bit of a play on words here. All those are put in front of the Ark of the Covenant. Then the next day, Moses goes to collect them, and Aaron's staff has buds, blossoms, and mature almonds on it. So overnight, from this dead wood, we have life, full life, that has blossomed forth. So Moses takes these staffs out, and shows them to the people of Israel. And there's one that stands out. There's one that is changed and is different. And it is only the God of the Creator that could have brought that life out of that which was not life. So as a sign then that Aaron is the one whom God has chosen to be able to represent the people to him. He is the selected priest for Israel. And this was done so that that God would put an end to their grumblings. I find it hard to believe that this would put an end to their grumblings in view of the fact that nothing else has put an end to their grumblings. They seem to be capable of grumbling in any case. However, there is something that's happened in the intervening time that may have had a profound effect on them, and that is we have had a large number of Israelites die. There were 14,700 who died in the plague. And I suspect among those 14,700, many of those were the ones who were inclined to grumble. So this, what remains of the Israelites, is probably a bit chastened. So all of that was done according to God's commandments, and it took place just as he said. That rod then is to be kept with the Ark of the Covenant as a reminder of this event. Then the last two verses of chapter 17. Then the sons of Israel spoke to Moses, saying, "Behold, we perish. We are dying. We are all dying. Everyone who comes near to the tabernacle of the Lord must die. Are we to perish completely?" This is curious. Now they're scared, because this is a God who's not afraid to pass out judgment, who's willing to put people to death. But they're thinking, but we cannot draw near and worship him. We are forbidden to worship him. So how we are in a situation where we are lose-lose. We can't draw near and worship him, and yet he is an angry God who kills people who are not faithful to him. So that's the dilemma that they're seeing themselves in. And the first part of 18, then, I think, is a reiteration of God's answer to that problem. And that the answer to that problem is, I have established an intermediary. It is Aaron and his descendants, the priesthood, that can go in and stand before God and act as an intermediary for you, the people, and appease God's wrath. Let me read the first seven verses of chapter 18. So the Lord said to Aaron, "You and your sons and your father's household with you shall bear the guilt in connection with the sanctuary, and you and your sons with you shall bear the guilt in connection with your priesthood. But bring with you also your brothers, the tribe of Levi, the tribe of your father, that they may be joined with you and serve you, while you and your sons with you are before the tent of the testimony. And they shall thus attend to your obligation and the obligation of all the tent. But they shall not come near to the furnishings of the sanctuary and the altar, lest both they and you die. And they shall be joined with you and attend to the obligations of the tent of meeting for all the service of the tent, but an outsider may not come near you. You shall attend to the obligations of the sanctuary and the obligations of the altar, so that there may no longer be wrath on the sons of Israel. And behold, I myself have taken your fellow Levites from among the sons of Israel. They are a gift to you, dedicated to the Lord, to perform the service for the tent of meeting. But you and your sons with you shall attend to your priesthood for everything concerning the altar and inside the veil, and you are to perform service. I am giving you the priesthood as a bestowed service, but the outsider who comes near shall be put to death." Much of this is just reiterating what has been said before and is elsewhere in the law. But essentially what is being said is, it is the responsibility of the priesthood, that is, Aaron and his descendants, to come in and perform the service in the tabernacle on behalf of all of the people. The others, those who are not of the priesthood, are forbidden to do that. It is only through an intermediary that you can appeal to God. The Levites have been assured that they still have a place, despite Korah's rebellion. And Korah was from the Levites. Despite Korah's rebellion, that privilege has not been taken away from the Levites. They help with the service. That is, they do the behind-the-scenes type activities. And they help in the outer portion of the courtyard. But they are not to go into the inner sanctuary. That's reserved for the priests and the priests alone. So God's response to the people's appeal is, you can have access to me, but it will only be through an intermediary. It won't be on your terms, it'll be on my terms. And my terms are, I have set up someone who will mediate that. Okay, I will not read the rest of chapter 18. I will just summarize what the rest of chapter 18 says. And that is, it says that the priests will have as a prerogative of their office, they will receive a portion of the things that are presented as offerings and sacrifices. That will be what they will eat. They will eat a portion of the sacrifices. They will eat a portion of the offerings. Those that are certain sacrifices can only be consumed by the priests themselves within the priestly sanctuary. There are other sacrifices that can be eaten by the whole priestly family, so including wife and children. But those will be for the priests. And the priests will not have their own property. They will not have another means for making a living. Their sustenance will come from as a byproduct of the sacrifices and offerings that are given to God by the people of Israel. The Levites, on the other hand, they will also be provided for, and they also will not have land on which they can raise their own food. They too will be eating a portion of what the rest of Israel produces. But what they will receive is a tithe. They will receive a tenth of what the Israelites produce. And that will be their sustenance. I find this interesting that God would make such a provision. Because in essence then, the well-being of the priests and the Levites is dependent upon the faithfulness of the people of Israel and their faithfulness to carry out the law as God has asked them to do. That the priests will receive food and sustenance to the degree that the Israelites are faithful to do their offerings and their sacrifices. And the Levites will be provided for to the extent that the Israelites do pay their 10% that they are obligated to pay. As a consequence, then, the well-being of the priest becomes a barometer, in a sense, of the spiritual health of the nation of Israel. If the priests are starving, that means that the people of Israel are neglecting their responsibilities with respect to God. And God has set it up that way. The priests have no independent source of making a living. They are devoted solely to carrying out the duties of the temple and the tabernacle. Okay, that's all I plan to cover today. We have lots of time for questions, if people have questions, comments.
This is an indirectly related. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about your use of the word Yahweh versus the name Jehovah, mm-hmm. given the Hebrew characters.
Why am I saying Yahweh instead of Jehovah?
Yeah.
Jehovah was the, as I understand it, Jehovah is the way that that word was transposed, transliterated into English. And it has the right consonants in it, but apparently the vowels are not the vowels that correspond to the ancient Hebrew text. So Yahweh is the pronunciation using those same consonants, but the right vowels as best as that can be determined. And that's confused by the fact that the ancient Hebrew text uses the consonants for Yahweh, but that name was never to be pronounced by the Jews, because it was holy. So they would use the consonants of Yahweh, but they would put the vowels of Adonai, which means Lord. And that's, as I understand it, that's how the confusion came about. But I'm using the term because when you see Lord in italics in the Old Testament text, at least in most editions, this is the way it is, that stands for Yahweh. And you'll see sometimes it's Lord God, that would be Yahweh Elohim. Sometimes it's just Elohim, and sometimes it's just Yahweh. And which name is used is, I think, purposeful and significant. It is not, however, crystal clear to me what the purpose is, but I'm confident there is a purposeful use for those.
So if they didn't say, if the Jews or Israelites didn't say Hashem, would they say Yehovah or would they say Yahweh?
In the ancient time?
When they read it. Well, even now.
Adonai. Whenever they come in the text to Yahweh,
yeah,
they say Adonai, which means Lord.
Okay. So the vowels would not come out to be Jehovah. They would come out to be.
Well, my understanding is that when it was translated into the English, uh-huh, back in the King James time, they used the consonants of Yahweh, but they used the wrong vowel sounds.
Okay.
And I think that came from Adonai, but I'm not sure how we get Jehovah out of those vowels.
I'm a little bit new to reading the Bible, so this might be a bit of a ridiculous question, but I was just curious before the canonization of the Bible and like way back when and all that jazz, what exactly would the priests do? What sort of texts would they read? And like back in that time, what was their main responsibility? Was it solely praying, or did they read as like holy texts as well? And
back at that time, being the time of Moses.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at the time of Moses, my assumption is that that none of the Old Testament would have been written. According to tradition, Moses is the author of the first five books of the Old Testament. So before he wrote that, there are no texts that they're working from. God spoke, it says here in Numbers and elsewhere, God spoke to Moses man to man. Unlike with anyone else, at least at that time, God spoke to Moses man to man. And that's even distinctive from how God approaches a prophet and speaks to a prophet. So Moses is receiving this from God, and presumably he is recording this, and it becomes the first five books of the Old Testament. But other than that, they don't have text that they're working from. But they do have, the Pentateuch then will be recorded. It becomes written record that the Israelites keep. And then later on, once Israel is established, that is copied. The king is required to rewrite that, to copy it out, I think yearly. So it becomes a text that with which they are very familiar. But that's quite a bit later.
Two questions, please.
Mm-hmm.
I'm having trouble getting a handle on the group identity that these people had,
mm-hmm,
as opposed to the individual responsibility. And it's hard to imagine holding a group accountable or a group responsible for things because of my culture,
mm-hmm,
without him being able to move in the individuals or hold the individuals accountable, because every group is just an assembly of individuals. How does that responsibility and guilt work in what we're seeing here? I mean, can you try to...
I can try. I think that's a very difficult question. Because, for instance, when the ground opened up and swallowed Korah, Dathan and Abiram, it didn't just swallow up them, it swallowed up their whole households, including their children. So they all suffered as a result of what their fathers had done. There are a couple of things that I think at least need to be considered here. One is, these are not acts of ultimate judgment. So what is, if we take an infant born to Korah, such an infant was destroyed, was killed in that incident. What happens to his soul, I think, is a separate question. So I'm not sure that that's ultimate judgment with respect to each of those individuals. Same thing with the plague. The people who died, I think, were not necessarily those who grumbled against God. But that's not necessarily an ultimate judgment with respect to them. The other thing is, I think what God is doing here is painting pictures in history. And what he's doing is he is acting with respect to Israel as a whole. He is treating his people as a unit. And if blessing comes to Israel, blessing comes to Israel. If curse comes to Israel, curse comes to Israel. And he's not being very selective. And I think that becomes a picture of how God deals, to a certain extent, that has an analogy with how God deals with individuals, with us as individuals. I mean, I think there are certain parallels between how God relates to Israel as a group and how God deals with us as individuals. So I think part of what's going on here is picture painting. God is using history to paint pictures that he can then draw upon later on to communicate important truths. And in so doing, he's chosen to not be, not necessarily be real selective as to who all is hurt in a judgment that comes on Israel or a portion of Israel.
So it's not the threat necessarily of eternal condemnation that is hanging over their heads. I mean, you could ask, well, this is not a behavior modification program, right?
Right.
I mean, he's not like, I'm going to wipe these people out, and you better watch your step. It's just that, well, yeah, I may wipe them out, but I may gather them to myself.
Right. I think that's right. I mean, there's a sense in which there's a certain amount of behavior modification going on here, but that's not ultimately what he's interested in. And he's trying to paint this picture in history, and the people play a role in that picture. But if someone who is not rebellious dies in order for this picture to take the shape that he wants it to take, then that's not ultimately a problem, because we aren't talking about the ultimate fate of that person. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's like it's a metaphor.
Yeah.
Rebellion on this issue brings about physical death. Rebellion on the issue brings about eternal death.
Right. And I would suspect that there are a number of these people who perished as a result of God's judgment that will not be in heaven. I mean, they sinned unto death. And with respect to the 250 who burned incense in their censers, it says, why don't you refer to that? I'm not finding it right now, but the men who have sinned at the cost of their lives. I think in general that's the sin unto eternal death in their case.
The other question would be the relative weights of the laws. And this is only because I've been watching the Seventh-day Adventist channel, mm-hmm. and trying to, think the way they think. Here's a man who defiantly gathers wood on the Sabbath. He's gone. They execute him. Mm-hmm. And yet there's a law that says you shall not covet, but they don't have thought police.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And I think my best answer to that is what God is in his painting a picture in history. And in history at this time in Israel, what he's trying to establish is, I take this law seriously. I really want you to do this, and I want you to take it seriously. I am responsible for punishing people, and I will punish people for disobedience. It's not that God is ultimately interested in the minute details of all of this, but he's establishing his authority here at the beginning. And I liken it to a parent with a child, that when a child is young, you lay down the law. You say, I don't care what the situation is, you do not cross the street without holding my hand. Why? Because the child doesn't understand enough yet to be in a position to make his own determination when he'll cross the street. So I'm just going to lay down the law and establish, I'm serious about what I say you do and what you don't do. We're going to start here with a behavioral kind of thing. And as you get older, then I will make clearer what all the principles are that are involved. And we'll move on. And eventually, you'll cross that street without holding on to my hand. But at this point, it's going to be, you do what I say, I mean it. And I think that's the kind of phenomenon we see here in Israel's early history.
David, when Aaron interceded, how many people do you think was in that tent? Do you have any kind of...
In which tent?
The tent of meeting, where the plague struck?
No, the plague is striking the whole congregation. So we're talking about the whole encampment.
So it's not just in the tent.
It's not just in the tent. So it's in the encampment in general. And he is told to go in, so he would be going into the tabernacle, getting coals from the altar, and putting that in his censer, putting incense into the censer. Then he goes out into the camp, and he stands where in between where people are dying and where they're still living.
Okay, and I just want to follow up one of the questions he asked you didn't answer, and that, what are the priests doing besides burning incense? Since they're not reading from a text,
right?
What were they doing?
Well, they have, it's just a matter of going through all of the prescribed rituals. So they have, things have to be set up, things have to be maintained, the fire has to be kept going, things need to be cleaned and kept tidy, and then there are offerings that are brought in and offered, there are sacrifices that are brought in. So they have, there's a lot, and there are a lot of those that have to be performed. So those are the things that they're doing.
Maybe you talked about this last week, but what would be appealing about that? Why would these group of people want to do that?
Well, I think that there's the assumption that there is power involved there. And later on, we see that corrupt priests take advantage of their position. And it's kind of like, the way I think of it is, I remember hearing controversy about, I can't remember which president it was of the United States, but there was controversy about who got their offices where in the White House. And everybody wants their office as close as possible to the president's office. Well, why? Because if you're close to the president, you can have the most impact on his thinking. So I think here the question is access to God. Is everybody going to have access to God, or are we going to have to go through gatekeepers? And whoever the gatekeepers are, they're the real power brokers. So I think that's the appeal. That's what they want. What the people are attracted to is this unmediated access to God so that they have more influence and power than they would otherwise have.
And God's response to that is, I get to say who has access to me, and it's on my terms, not yours.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what the people are having a difficult time with. They want it on their terms and in their way, and God's saying, no, I am only doing it through an intermediary, and that intermediary will be of my choosing and not yours.
So the fact that they see Moses and Aaron as the problem is, how does that factor in?
How does that factor in?
Right.
I think they see them as the gatekeepers, as the way it's set up right now.
So they wouldn't, God wouldn't be one who would keep them from that but Moses and Aaron would.
Keep the people from it.
Right. I
mean, absolutely. That as gatekeepers, they are not being, they are not truly representing the interests of the Israelites. They're representing their own interests before God.
They would see that Moses and Aaron are not interested.
Right.
Not, okay.
And
it would be difficult for them to imagine God thinking about that the way he's thinking about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way they're seeing it, we are holy. We need to have direct access to God in order for this to work right.
So I have two questions.
Mm-hmm.
One is, you said that we want to see God the way we want to see God, not the way God really is. And is this discussion you just had with Larry part of, is that what you were referring
yes,
to?
Yes, absolutely. Right. That the Israelites, they wanted God to be approachable on their terms rather than on the terms that God has dictated. And they found that problematic.
Okay. The second question is, I don't know if this is an Old Testament, New Testament thing, but God is really tying obedience to letting people live and disobedience to having people die.
Mm-hmm.
Just watched Bonhoeffer documentary yesterday about, you know, the Jews, so they're very much on my mind from World War II, and I'm wondering if there's a continued correlation between the death of the Jews and disobedience, and, you know, I in this day and age don't see my obedience connected to death or
mm-hmm.
even being punished necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
So, help me out.
Okay. Well, I think, again, this tie between what's being tied here in this section of the Old Testament is behaviors and physical death. And I think that ultimately that's not what God is concerned about. Ultimately what God is concerned about is our hearts, and the ultimate fate of our souls is tied to that. But he's picture painting here that to help establish that connection that God is serious about what he requires, and that our fate is determined by how we respond to God. So ultimately, I think that's always what he's been concerned with. And in the Old Testament, New Testament, but in the Old Testament, he's using the physical history, the history as we saw it, to paint the picture that he then draws upon later to make the more profound connection between our hearts and our eternal destiny. The Jews in World War II, I find it interesting that the term that's been attached to that is Holocaust. And I think that may be, that there may be something appropriate to that, that there is a sense in which the nation of Israel was put to death as kind of a sacrifice for all of mankind in some way. Is there a judgment involved there? There might be a judgment involved there as well, that because of the nation of Israel's rebelliousness towards God throughout history, that may be may have been a judgment that served as much in the same way as the killing of the 14,700 here, to waken people up and to help encourage them to see things differently. And I think that in modern times we are seeing some of that movement. It seems to me within the Jewish community there is a discernible shift in the way that Jews are thinking about their own tradition and about who God is. And we'll just have to see how that progresses. And if it turns into true repentance as a nation or not. You look puzzled, so there must be another question there.
I don't think I understand your answers very well.
Okay.
And I'm not sure what to ask, especially with the answer right before when you were talking about
the physical.
Is this what you mean, that there was a physical, in the Old Testament, there was physical punishment that was a picture of what happens when we ultimately disobey God? Our hearts aren't broken, aren't wanting God. That's not what's generally happening anymore. We still...
Right.
He's always wanted our hearts to be toward him, but he's no longer... Usually, there's not usually physical death, but there may have been with the Jews.
Right, right. And I think what's happening there is God is dealing with them that way. He's saying, here's what I say to do. If you don't do it, I will kill you. That is a picture in a way that we can actually see it, of a more profound reality, and that is, what I require of you is an inner allegiance with me, that is a devotion to me. And if you don't do that, there is a consequence, and that is eternal death. So in history, with Israel in particular, and Israel is the vehicle through which God primarily has used to reveal himself to mankind. So in their history, he painted a picture in which he attaches obedience to him or judgment. But it's that the physical death is not the thing that's ultimately to be our concern. It's the analog to that. That is our eternal fate.
Can I ask another question?
Sure.
So you were saying that this isn't necessarily death that will lead to eternal death, but just a physical death. I don't understand where in the text you see that.
Well, I'm not seeing it in the text. I'm just speculating. We've got children that are dying as a result. We have Korah's children dying as a result of Korah's sin. We could have a one-month-old infant that's dying because of Korah's sin. I don't think that infant is dying for his sin. I mean, maybe, but I don't think so. So I'm just guessing then that God is not necessarily concerned with making a one-to-one correlation between the condition of a person's heart and the physical judgment that takes place. So I think it's possible that you have members of Korah's household that could be in heaven, even though they died in that historical incident. Does that make sense? Okay. Okay, thanks.